Thank you for being here. We are in 1 Samuel 18, and we're kind of in the middle of that chapter. It's a great story right now. We're in the middle of some great details of David's life as he's rising to power. The details, the more we learn about archaeology and history, the more this story makes sense. We've got a map. I handed it out last week, but I also have it again this week. We'd be on the second map on that. It's the important places are right here. Jabesh right here is the city of Jerusalem. It's really not a non-issue at this time in our story. The real place that's important is this place, the high place of Geba right here. That's where Samuel anointed Saul. Samuel is from Ramah, the whole hometown. It's very close. You can stand on the high place here and see Ramah. You can see Gibeah right in here. And this is where Saul is from. It's all very easy walk. You can stand here and see Jerusalem or Jabesh. This is about 2 miles. The city of Nob is where the tabernacle or the priests are at. We talk about this being a high place right here, a place of worship. But the priests have kind of relocated, coming out of Shiloh, have relocated at Nob. Nob is a question on the location of it, but I believe it's Isaiah 10, verse 32. I'll give you the verse here in just a minute. Well, I can give you the verse right now if I just take a moment. Isaiah chapter 10, verse 32, the Lord is prophesying through Isaiah that the enemies, when they come to destroy Jerusalem, now they were jumping, this is like, you know, say 1020 B.C., 1015 B.C., we're jumping into a prophecy written like 700 B.C., 300 years in the future. But Isaiah talks about the enemy coming to Nob and looking at the hills of Jerusalem and shaking their fists at Jerusalem. So there's three basic locations of where Nob is at. They're all in this general area. But it appears if you've been to Jerusalem and you stand on the Temple Mount and look kind of northeast, or if you stand on the Mount of Olives, and look down here at the Jerusalem this way and look to the north, Nob would be just that continues to climb up a rise a little bit, maybe one of the high spots right just within vision of Jerusalem. So that's where the priests are. Those places are all coming in. Again, remember King Saul, his palace, which is not much of a palace because it's early in Israel's history. And it had been excavated. They discovered it, but it's been covered up through some other modern work, is in Gibeah. David is from Bethlehem. He's going to be going back and forth to Saul. Today, David's going to leave Saul and go up and talk to Samuel at Ramah. And there's going to be another place called Naoth, which is located in Ramah. Naoth is going to be, it may be a noun that means camp or camps. And basically, Naoth is going to be, in modern days, it would be a dormitory. It would be an apartment complex. It's a place, Naoth is a place in Ramah where the prophets live. So the prophets that are under Samuel's leadership, under Samuel's training in the city of Ramah, they live at Naoth, or a place called the camps. They live in the college dormitory, you know, or whatever, is a place where the prophets live. David's going to leave Gibeah, go to Naoth in Ramah to see Samuel. Samuel's going to have some things happen there. He's going to then leave and go to the priest at Nob, and some things are going to happen there. And from there, he's going to end up fleeing. And so that's all taking place here, a little bit of geography at this time. So any questions on that? It's on the maps there, kind of laid out. It's very small. I should have just made a big map for you, but instead I tried to squeeze too many maps on the page. Any questions about that? Otherwise, I'm going to pray, and we're going to read through the story this evening. Father, do thank you for the opportunity to look at the history of how you've worked in the lives of individuals and the lives of nations. We thank you that your work in history continues as we look at situations in our own world, in our own life. We know that you are still leading and guiding us, preparing us, just as you're preparing David for things. Here in this story tonight, you are preparing all of us for some event or some growth or something you have planned for us. That our lives are not mere vanity, but are lived for a purpose as we continue to grow in Christ and fulfill the plans you have in history. Father, we do thank you for this encouragement and the hope we have through Jesus Christ. In his name we pray, amen. So here we go. 1 Samuel chapter 18. And we've just finished the story in chapter 17 of David killing Goliath, where David kind of has risen up as a hero, defeating the Greek champions, or the Philistine champion in a Greek-style battle, a duel. He became popular and famous. He received a place of leadership. He's gone to battle. One of the key verses that we can see is in chapter 18, verses 1 through 5. That is where David and Jonathan are kindred spirits. They form a covenant. And this is important right here to understand verses 1 through 5. David and Jonathan are swearing a covenant to each other. Like we said before, God's got a covenant with Israel, and they have a covenant, a bond that they have. And that's very, very common. It's like a contract. Jonathan and David, they make a contract with each other. Saul has a contract with Israel as the king. We saw Samuel help lead him into that covenant. And so that's what David and Jonathan are making a covenant. That's where the verse 3, and Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And there's your word covenant. And then the word loved is the word hased. It means covenant love. It's the love that God has for Israel. Again, we live in our Western world, and the word love means emotion and passion. And the word so often here in the Hebrew text is really this: it means covenant. It means commitment. God isn't emotionally connected with Israel, although there's a way of talking about that too. The Lord is under contract. He's in covenant relationship with Israel, which it's not based on his emotions, it's not based on his feelings, it's based on a covenant, the word, if you would. And so anyway, Jonathan and David form a covenant. That's going to play out real big here as our story continues. Saul begins to become angry, begins to rot, in a sense, emotionally and attitude-wise on the inside. That's the words angry and galled in verse 8. Because the people are excited about Saul, they're glad to have a king. He's the king, they honor the king. But man, we've got a hero coming right behind him. Here's David the hero. Saul has slain his thousands. Yes, here's the king. But here comes David, the one who slayed tens of thousands. Oh, and that's where all the girls start screaming and passing out like the Beatles are on the Ed Sullivan Show. And it's like, wait, that Saul wanted that. You know, it'd just be like Ed Sullivan getting jealous of the Beatles or something. It's like, well, you know, it's the Beatles. You just got it. And this is David. It's just the people love David. Verse 10, the next day an evil spirit came on Saul. Verse 12, Saul is afraid of David because the Lord was with David but had left Saul. So it's not just a popularity thing. David is functioning under the leadership. Of course, we know he's been anointed by Samuel. And then in verse 15, when Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. And again, that word successful is going to come up several times as we continue to read through this chapter. David, that word refers to wisdom. It refers to skill. It refers to execution. It's the ideal of not just being lucky and being successful. It means David approaches a situation, analyzes it, figures out a way of resolving it in a way that, just like he went out and fought Goliath. That would be skill or success or wisdom. They had all the other battle plans, and they couldn't figure out how they're going to defeat Goliath. And David says, well, I'll go out at him with a sling. I'll kill him like I killed the bear. It's not that big. He's going to stand there. I'm going to throw a stone at him. It's like, oh, wow, that's really wise. That's pretty simple. It's like, and that was the way David handled these things, not just with David and Goliath's story, but in all of the battles. Everybody else is using their typical battle formations. And David said, well, let's mix this up a little bit. And he defeated. It's like, well, that was a really good idea. Then everybody else started doing it. And David had that kind of skill, that kind of wisdom. And that's what the word it says, when Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. In other words, Saul realizes, I don't think like that. I think in the typical step one, step two, step three, I think like everybody else thinks. David's thinking out of the box. I'll never be able to keep up with this. He's going to continue to have more success. And Saul became afraid of David, knowing this kid is, no one's going to stop him. He's gifted. So in verse 17, now he's going to start trying to, you know, do whatever he can do. He's going to start trying to unravel David's success, try to come in from the backside and trip him up. It says in verse 16, but all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns. That word campaigns means he went forth and came back at the head of the troops. And we're going to see the word campaign, at least in the NIV. It means he went out and came back at the head of the troops, which means it's one thing to go to battle in front of the troops, but it's another thing to, after the battle's all over, you lead them back home successfully. It's like, oh, you didn't get killed. Oh, no, I went out first, and I came back still in my position. And that the campaign, he went out in the front and came back in the front day after day. It's like, how are we ever going to get rid of David? So, here we go. Verse 17. Now, this is all now Saul begins to figure out how he's going to get rid of David. Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." For Saul said to himself, "I will not raise a hand against him," because everybody loves David, "but I will let the Philistines do that." So, and it was very common. It was a practice. There'd be a price set for a bride. If a father had a daughter, if someone wants to marry her, okay, you can marry her, but it's going to cost you, and there'd be a price. It wasn't necessarily a standard price. He would set the bride price. And you can see the bride price kind of camouflaged in this verse. It says, "Here's my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you in marriage only," here's the contract, "serve me bravely and fight the battles. All I ask, you keep doing what you're doing. Get out there and kill some more Philistines." And they'll kill you first, but never mind. She'll be a widow, but then we'll just move on with life and my kingship will be secure. That's what he's thinking. But David said to Saul, "Who am I and what is my family or my father's clan in Israel that I should become the king's son-in-law?" So when the time came for Merab, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel of Maholah. And now again, you can look in 2 Samuel 21:8 if you want to. 2 Samuel 21:8, and they have five sons. Merab has five sons with this other husband, and they're recorded in Saul's genealogy. Now again, David is a hero. David is popular. He's on the cover of the magazines, and everybody knows his name. And he's meeting with success. But what he's talking about here is not, well, it's going to come up again. He doesn't have a family that is worthy to step into royalty or marry at this level, nor does he have the money, the finances, to live at this kind of a standard. He's, this is not my kind of lifestyle. And it's going to mean he's going to come up again. Okay. Now, verse 20. Now, Saul's daughter, Michal, was in love with David. And that's interesting. There's a very unusual reference in the Scriptures of someone being, now watch this, think about this, you don't have to accept this, but of someone being in love with another person. I mean, as far as Michal was in love with David. You think of all, like I was talking to Tony yesterday after church because of the subject matter. Think about what we talked about in church. And I said, just think of all the great love stories in the Bible. You think about Isaac and Rebecca, and Jacob and there's four of them. It's like, well, those weren't great love stories. Remember Isaac and Rebecca? Abraham says to his servant Eliezer, "Go back to our home country, go back up to Haran, and find a wife and bring her back for Isaac." And so she's riding a camel back. And Isaac goes out. She sees Isaac. She covers herself up, and this was, you know, this is Isaac. They went through the ceremony, and he went into her tent, and she unveiled herself. And "Hi, I'm Isaac." This is a great love story. It was like, what was it? There was no falling in love. It was a contract. It was a covenant once again, and they became, you know, a couple. They became under contract. Jacob, you know, he falls in love with Rachel, right? And then he ends up being given, after 7 years of work, her sister Leah. And then you got that whole strange story about he goes in into the tent on the night of the feast, the wedding feast, and in the morning he realizes this isn't Rachel. It's like, what's going on here? Well, again, the veil, they're covered up. I mean, and it's completely different. So to have us, and that's why, I'm rambling here, I'm sorry. But yesterday we talked in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, and it's talking about the marriage relationship and the responsibilities of marriage, but nowhere in there does it say anything. And this is what I was telling Tony. I'm just rambling. It doesn't say anything about love. It doesn't say anything about emotion. It talks about your responsibilities as a married couple. Yes, but what about love? Paul, I'm not talking about love. I'm talking about your responsibility in the marriage covenant. But aren't we supposed to be in love? Yeah, I don't understand what you're talking about. We're talking about a contract. It's just really interesting because, and here's what I told Tony. Yeah, I'm prefacing that because that's why I'm rambling on about this. Is it's funny when you go to a wedding and what do you read at a wedding? You go to 1 Corinthians and you read what chapter? 13, about love. It's not about marriage. It's not about weddings. Weddings are about, in what chapter? Chapter 7. So the next wedding I do, I'm going to say, I'm not reading chapter 13. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and see what the apostle really says about marriage. Because chapter 13, he's talking about spiritual gifts and functioning as a body of believers, living together as a Christian community. Let's talk about marriage, chapter 7. And it's like, there's nothing here about love. No, it's like, you have losing you're now taking your bodies and you're sharing responsibility. You're losing the authority of your body and giving it to your spouse and vice versa. You now have two people in charge of your body. Are you ready for this? It's like, yeah, you're going to need love to pull this off. But isn't it kind of funny? If you pull out 1 Corinthians chapter 7 at your next wedding and see, what are you talking about? I'm talking about the apostles' view of marriage. But anyway, that all came from this simple verse. Yes, oh no, a question. Well, it doesn't mean Hasid. It's not Hasid. She doesn't covenant. You know, we talk about Jonathan and David loved each other. They had a, you know, I don't know. I off the top of my head, I can't tell you the Hebrew. In the context, so again, I don't know the definite meaning in the Hebrew of that word, but in the context, it appears more like the fan love of, you know, in 1964, a teenager loving Paul McCartney, or you know. So I mean, it's more. I think that's because he's a superstar. So that, I think all the girls are going to love David like this. Jonathan's got a covenant with David. Micah has passion for David. Again, I don't know the Hebrew word. I should have looked that up. Yes. Oh, no. No. No, I think David is like, I think all the girls love David. And I think, I'll just read, again, they may, I don't think David is involved in this. Maybe. But David says, Saul, who am I? Okay. Now, Saul's daughter, Michal, was in love with David. And when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. I'll give him to her. I think his people are telling him. I think I think there's strategies on that. What do you guys think? Do you think, is that the way that reads to you guys, that David and Michal are in love? I mean, I've never looked at it that way. I look at it as, and I may be wrong, that's why I'm saying, I've never approached it that way. I've always approached it with, there's this group of people that have said, hey, I know you tried to get Amara, but Michal loves him. Maybe David's in love with Michal. Maybe, I don't know. Has anybody else considered that? I mean, let's read it that way. I've never thought of it that way. Yeah. I think the way I read this, and again, I may be blind, as I'm beginning blind, but I think David's getting blindsided. I think David is using Michal to blindside David. David's busy off killing Philistines, and Saul's trying to get him hooked up. Let's read on, see how it flows. Right. You'll get the salt. Yeah. Yeah, that was part of the promise of the taxation. And yeah. He's already earned a daughter. Right. And I don't know where that just kind of fizzles out. I mean, it never really plays out as something. But yeah, he should already have married a royal daughter because of David or Goliath. Also, the taxation, all that stuff, there won't be paid taxes. You'll have a financial reward and you'll get a daughter you'll be married in. Maybe he already said no. Maybe he said no to that. Merib is the second attempt. I mean, I don't know. But okay, But daughters are very important right here. Now, Saul's daughter, Michal, was in love with David. And when they told Saul about it, see, that they, David and Michal, went to him and said that, that would almost secure the marriage, I would think. So when the court, I think people in the court, when the word got up the ladder to Saul, when they told Saul, your daughter's in love with David, and you know he's rejected Merib, it pleased him. He was pleased. I will give her to him, he thought, so that she may be a snare to him. Now, is that not just what you want to do with your daughter? Snare a man and make him kill himself. I will give her to him, he thought, so that she may be a snare to him, and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul said to David, now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law. Now, actually, it would be his third opportunity if you're counting from David and Goliath. But anyway, something happened to that part of the story. It just falls away. Probably in the excitement of the parade and everything. So Saul said to David, now you have a second chance. Then Saul ordered his attendants, speak to David privately. And it appears David is like, no. And so he doesn't want to move into that area. So he says, talk to his attendants, playing people against people. Speak to David privately and say, look, the king is pleased with you and his attendants all like you. Now become his son-in-law. Meaning, the king wants you in his family. All the people in his palace, the royal court, all of the attendants, they already like you. You fit in this. You fit with us. You're one of us. Now just marry and become his son-in-law and join the family. Join the group here in the palace. They repeated these words to David. But David said, do you think it is a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? You think I'm going to do that just so I can fit into the group? I mean, to marry the king's daughter, that comes with some responsibilities. Not just with, hey, come on in and party with us. It's like that comes with responsibility. Yeah, but now he's going to give a little more right here. He says, do you think it's a small matter? Now he says, I'm only a poor man and little known. Okay, so now it's like, wait a minute, how poor are you and how little? You're famous, everybody loves you. And, I mean, you're in a sense, you're a celebrity. So you should have some kind of wealth. I think he's talking about family standing and little known. As far as genealogy, as far as family inheritance, he's a nobody. He's the eighth son of someone from Bethlehem. So again, he's famous, but he's really, I bring nothing to the table. Meaning, I can't afford this kind of a lifestyle once again. So Saul's going to set the price. So Saul's servants told him what David had said. Saul replied, say to David, the king wants no other price. Now that, when it says, I'm only a poor man, this is the answer to that. The king wants no other price. You don't need to pay anything. The only price I'll need for the bride, then 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on my enemies. I need you to kill 100 Philistines. Now, again, the foreskins, that's a little gross. All of a sudden, this little Sunday school story becomes R-rated, X-rated. We can't tell the children the story. Or we have a lot of other questions. It's like, whoa, what's the foreskin? It's like, okay, never mind. Let's just say you got to kill 100 Philistines. We keep reading. Now, before we go any further with that, we've mentioned before that we've even maybe handed out some pictures of, not of foreskins, but of hands of being cut off in battle. You know, where they'd have, Egyptians would have hands piled up. Have we ever showed any pictures of that? They'd have like hands. What they do, they cut off the right hand. After the battle, they cut off the right hand and pile them up. And then there'd be in the inscription, sometimes there'd be a guy with a tablet and they're counting hands. So you know how many people you killed, but you keep the right hand or you keep the heads. So that was very common to collect body parts for counting. David, for example, took Goliath's head. That was kind of like one, you know, got one. Now, I've mentioned this book before, and I wanted to show you, I'm going to read this to you right here. This is the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Bible Background Commentary, okay, from Zondervan. It's 5 volumes. And then there's a New Testament one that is 4 volumes. I think it's either, yeah, I don't know, they're 4 or 5 volumes of each. This is from 2000, let me give you the exact date. This was published in 2009, it looks like. Yeah, 2009. So, I mean, that's why it's referring to the Nephilim or the large skeletons that were found over in the Gaza Strip. It is in a book like this that's got, I mean, it's fairly new. Right here on this part, this is a commentary, but it's all historical background. recent stuff, stuff that's kind of cutting edge as far as... Now, I just want to read this to you just so you understand a little bit about how you, this... Because it's from a conservative point of view, meaning it presents things that supports the Scriptures. Payment of a bride price was common in the Old Testament world, as it still is in some cultures. It was the prerogative of the bride's father to set the price, and Saul sets it dangerously high at 100 Philistine foreskins. Body parts, heads, hands, etc., often served as trophies of war, Goliath's head, and Saul's unusual choice is designed to assure that David actually kills the Philistines. That's why they cut off the right hands. We actually killed these people. Remember Jerubbaal, what's his name? Gideon. When he goes down and sweeps on the east side of the Jordan River, he meets a city. They say, hey, come help us. They say, have you already got the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna? I don't think so. Meaning, can you show us their hands? You haven't killed anybody yet. We're not going to join you because they're still alive. They'll come back and kill us. So Gideon says, when I get done and I've got their hands, I'll come back and burn your place down. And so what they wanted was that sign, count. You got those two hands. So it was common. Now right here, Merenphath, great Libyan war inscription. It's Merenptah. It's a place in Egypt. It's inscriptions on a hieroglyphics on a wall as part of a palace, part of a burial chamber. And it has several things that are useful there, describing things. But anyway, it repeatedly mentions, okay, and this is a very thing, I've referred to this several times in Reps and Sets, I just can't pronounce it, repeatedly mentions that the Philae with foreskins were being collected from slain enemies. So in other words, on that inscription, it also talks, that's a weird story, collecting foreskins. The Egyptian hieroglyphic says that in some places, it's a common thing of that, well, one of the things, they would collect foreskins. This shows that the request made of David is not that odd. That's the whole reason I'm reading that to you. Is this request to us is like, that's weird. In this world, right here, this shows that this request made by David was not odd at 1000 BC. David meets Saul's challenge twice over, presenting 200 foreskins. Saul views this success as evidence that Yahweh is with David, and his fear of him grows into a full-blown enmity. Okay, so we go back to the text. Anyway, I wanted to show you that because that's kind of, for me, that's exciting stuff because many of those weird stories in the Bible, it'll come on and tell you, it's like, yeah, it's weird to you in Des Moines, Iowa in the year 2014. But you go back to 1000 BC, the Egyptians are writing the same way. Now, there's only one way you're going to know that is if you get, you know, some kind of a literary advice or device. And these are, again, not just weird things written by people, but these are archaeologists, a collection of archaeology and information. Anyway, go back to the story, please. Well, it's 100 Philistine foreskins. The idea there is so that he's got an actual count, and 100 is so that David has a good chance of getting killed. Verse 26, when the attendants have told David these things, he was pleased to become the king's son-in-law. Okay. I can do that. If that's what it takes, I can do that. So before the allotted time elapsed, David and his men went out and killed 200 Philistines. He brought their foreskins. Again, you're trying to get a picture of a bag, you know, grocery bag of, it's like, oh my, it's like, you know, it's easier to imagine the Goliath's head. But anyway, he brings in 200 foreskins and presented the full number of the king to the king so that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave him his daughter Michal in marriage. You think during the marriage ceremony that the bride price was mentioned, you know, David, I give you this wife, this daughter because of what the price of, you know, it's like, you know, it's just another different culture. Verse 28, when Saul realized that the Lord was with David because he came back successful and that his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. Meaning he's going to spend the rest of his time against David. It's going to be a very, very difficult time for David. And I think as we read through this, for personal use right here, we can all look at this and you can see David is already anointed of God. He's already successful. He's on track to being what God wants him to be. But it's like, there's some things that need to be worked on in David. David needs to go through a period of testing. And we don't want to be tested. We don't want to be tried. We don't want things in our life to become complicated. But at the same time, who we are before tests and training and trials and situations is different than who we are when we come out on the other side. I mean, we all know that from experience. And David, at early on in these tests, there's several things you can see in David's life. One of the things is he's going to meet these tests with, yeah, he's going to talk about Yahweh, talk about the Lord, but he's going to also have a little bit of human manipulation. He's going to combat Saul's human manipulation and motivating of different people and lying and deceiving and manipulating people to work his advantage. David's going to be, okay, I'm going to play this same chess game. And you can see David, we're going to see it. He's going to start moving people around on his chessboard of his political intrigues and trying to outplay Saul until it all backfires on him, because that's not the anointing. The anointing doesn't anoint you to play these human games. The anointing anoints you to do things in righteousness, in God's way, in boldness, and stand there and see what happens. It doesn't mean you don't use wisdom. David's using wisdom. He's using skill. But he's going to drop down and play on that same human chessboard. But after he gets burned playing that game, as the anointed one, he gets burnt playing the game by a man who doesn't even have the Spirit of God. It's like, okay, I'm going to stop playing this game, and I'm just going to play at a completely different level. And he starts playing and trusting in Yahweh, doing things right, still being wise, but trusting in Yahweh. Now all of a sudden, he's unbeatable. And you can see David going back. And that's something you can talk about. You can teach kids that in Sunday school. You can preach that in churches. David knows that he's a believer. He trusts God when he killed Goliath. But now to use that in pressure situations, we're going to have to practice. We're going to have to drill you. And he's going to now spend the next several years. It's not going to be a couple weekends. Several years, where it says right here, and Saul remained his enemy the rest of his days. It's like, and now Saul, really, why is Saul there? Saul has one basic purpose right here. Train David. Train David by hunting him like an animal. Go. And now David's running. It's like, who's doing this? The Lord, he's training you, David. And when you look behind it and you see that, it's like, I don't want to be David chasing around in my rest of my life like that. But at the same time, when you see what it does for David's character and his trust in God, then you got to kind of step back and say, is that happening in my own life? And are you playing the... Well, I'm preaching now. Here we go. Verse 28. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. So instead of Michal being a snare to trap and kill David, David's been successful, he's paid the bride price, and now David lives in the courts of Saul with a daughter that adores him, and he's now his son-in-law. It's like, yeah, that didn't work out like I wanted at all. Okay, the Philistine commanders continue to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success. There's that word again, successful. The Philistines kept coming across the border just like they did there at the Valley of Ephah. They come up to the borderline and press an attack. David goes off, drives them away with another strategy that no one thought of, and he meets with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. Now he's not just a celebrity, now he's not just popular, but he's now becoming one of the number one generals. Now he's got some, if you want to say, some kind of a reputation besides just fame. Chapter 19, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. Okay, now he tells Jonathan, you've got to kill David. Surely Jonathan's going to be on his father's side. Again, like I said, Jonathan is a great man. He recognizes David's faith. He recognizes David's boldness. He forms a covenant with David. But yet Jonathan never, in a sense, turns on his father, never stabs his father in the back. He plays brilliantly both sides of the fence in honesty and in righteousness. He's faithful to the man of God, commits to him in the future, says, I will serve you in the future. But he never goes over and says, oh, but I'll kill my dad for you. He goes with his dad. In fact, as we read on the story, Saul is going to go to his death on Mount Gilboa, and who's going to die with him? Jonathan is going to be right there, knowing this is so stupid. This is a losing battle, but he's going to stand. What do you do? You're the prince. What do you do? Say, Dad, this is dumb. I'm not going to fight today. If you're the prince, your father's marching to his death. It's like, what do you do? I guess you get on your horse if you're a man of God and ride to your death too, supporting your dad. And it's like, oh, and John, anyway, decide that, but watch, he plays this out. But anyway, Saul now says, I want you to kill David. But Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you, so be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I will go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and will tell you what I find out." In other words, go out there. I'm going to try to mediate this situation. Something went wrong between you and my father. I'm going to try to talk my dad through this. So instead of saying, okay, let's go kill David, he's going to, well, here he goes. And Jonathan does a great job of talking his dad back to sense. It's interesting, although he's demon-possessed, and I don't want to say demon-possessed, he's afflicted by a demon spirit, so Jonathan is able to talk reason to his father and talk him back into a logical, say, David's not your enemy. Well, here he goes. Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you, and what he has done has benefited you greatly." You'd still be standing out there at the Valley of Elah trying to figure out what you're going to do with Goliath. You know, 120 days of standing there looking at him. He's saving your reign as king. "He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory for all Israel, and you saw it and were glad." You were rejoicing the same way everyone was. "Why then would you do wrong to an innocent man like David by killing him for no reason except jealousy and fear?" Saul listened to Jonathan. And again, the word "listen" has an overtone of the word "obeyed." Saul obeyed Jonathan and took this oath. "As surely as the Lord lives," they're all capital letters, Yahweh, "as surely as Yahweh lives, David will not be put to death." He says, okay, I swear before Yahweh, I will not kill David. So Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation. He brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. So again, you see Jonathan, the great man, he worked it out. He mediated, brought them together. He got Saul to make a vow. Then he calls Jonathan, calls David, not on his cell phone, probably calls him, "Come on, it's okay, David. We've reconciled this. Shake hands, come on back home. Let's go have a hamburger or whatever." Okay. So now they're all happy. Everybody's happy. They lived happily ever after. Nice job, Jonathan. Verse 8. "Once more war broke out, and David went out and fought the Philistines. He struck them with such force that they fled before him." Okay? Excellent. "But an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand." Now, I'm not sure how that's connected. Maybe he heard the report. But he's sitting there on his throne, whatever kind of throne he had, has his spear, while David was playing his harp. So David, so far, when David plays his harp, he's come back as a harp player. He's been doing this before he killed Goliath. Now he's playing his harp. He's back there as before and comforting Saul in his torment. But now, even as David, the anointed harp player, is playing, the Spirit comes on Saul. And here goes this, another attack. "Saul tried to pin him to the wall with his spear, but David eluded him. As Saul drove the spear into the wall, that night David made good his escape." So while he's playing the harp, imagine he's over there, he's playing his harp, you know, if you want to picture a guitar or something. And, you know, Saul's kind of sitting on his throne thinking. And all of a sudden, Saul just picks up his spear and hurls it across. And somehow David dives out of the way, the spear sticks in the wall, which should be some interesting archaeological information of what kind of material was in the wall. It's like it wasn't just solid rock. It must have been some kind of wood paneling in there, in the rock. It was, you know, made out of rock covered up with wood. And David made good his escape. He escapes. Verse 11, "Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning." So David doesn't go home that night, probably in Gibeah, with where Micah's at. He flees somewhere else. But Saul sends men, because he realized David got away. So he sends men. They're all sitting out like, you know, some kind of a stake out waiting for David to come out to go to work in the morning. They're going to kill him when he comes out to go to work. But Micah, David's wife, warned him, "If you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed." He says, there's a stakeout for you. So Michal let David down through a window, and he fled and escaped. Now here's an interesting verse. I can maybe help you out with this one. Verse 13, "Then Michal took an idol," NIV translation, "and laid it on the bed, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair at the head." Okay, so apparently it's large, this idol is large enough that you can, you know, it's like if you put two or three pillows in the bed and, you know, just being a father, we've got several stories. It's a waste of time to tell you this, but you know this, you know how you, if you want to make something look, you put pillows in the bed. And our boys, one of our boys, I don't remember which one it was, they're old enough that we didn't even pay attention. They're old enough, they came and went as they would. They had a car, they had a license, they had a full-time job, whatever. And one of them, one time, then we got a walk-out door in the basement in one of their rooms. So they slide the door and walk out. And I'm upstairs, you know, it's a split level, so I'm up 3-4 stories up. We're asleep, we're oblivious, we don't even care. You know, but anyway, one night, they put pillows in the bed and made it look like they're in bed, and somehow Tony went down there and thought they were in bed, and then they came in and said, I thought you were in bed. It's like, and then they told the story. I said, we don't even care. Why did you think it was? It's like, you know, and they weren't like 12 years old. They're like, I don't know, 18 or something. I'll use 8, I don't know. But it's like, well, okay, anyway. Welcome to my house. She did the same thing. But anyway, the word idol there, now that throws some people. Anybody else have something different than the word idol? If you should have your footnotes, what does yours say, Sinai? Okay, yep. In the Hebrew word is teraphim. In fact, you can see at the end of the word, the I am, that like Elohim, Nephilim, or here, teraphim, I am. That's the plural. That's the Hebrew plural transferred into English. So teraphim. Now, we also see this word popping up several places in the Old Testament, and there for a while people didn't know what to do with the word teraphim. Is it some kind of idol? Because it's an image. We see Rachel stealing the teraphim from her father. Remember Rachel? She got in the camel and she comes back with Jacob and she puts the teraphim in her saddlebag. And her dad comes down and says, "You've stolen, someone's stolen all my household gods, my teraphim. And now what do I have? I've got nothing left." And if you translate it idol, you now all of a sudden have idol worshipers. Rachel is stealing the idols as she follows Jacob in God's plan. They're the people of God up there in Haran, and they're following idols. Now David is in Saul's house, who's anointed of Samuel, but his daughter Michal's got idols, and David's like, fine with this, right there by in the bedroom is some idols. It's like, how does this make sense? Okay, you can go with that if you want to, but more recent understanding of the word teraphim and research has, and you throw this into all those other Bible stories, a teraphim would be a statue, not of a god, but of an ancestor statue. And with that ancestor statue would be property rights, or ownership, or claims to the estate. Now does that make sense? Now all of a sudden when Rachel, she steals, she says, we've lost everything. I'm going to take these. These would be like title deeds for the family estate, the family inheritance, the family land that was handed down from this man to this man to this man. And their image, the family photos, represent the family title deeds. And she took them and she ran off with the property, the deeds to the property. And now what she's got in, or Michal's got in the house, does she have an idol, a Canaanite idol of a god? Possibly. But if you use that, this makes more sense. It's an image of some family ancestor that's a title deed, probably maybe part of her estate, part of her dowry. This is her inheritance from her side of the family, potentially. I don't know. But there's the word idol in the NIV. It's the word teraphim. And people are dancing around that, trying to translate that and find meaning. And sometimes when you translate it idol, like when the prophets condemn the people for idols, it doesn't make any sense. But when you put it into some kind of ancestor image, ancestral claims to estates, now all of a sudden it makes sense. Nonetheless, it's something made out of wood or something made out of stone that's big enough so you can put it in a bed, cover it up with some sheets, and put some goat hair on it, make it look like David's asleep and he's not feeling well. He really doesn't feel well. Look at his hair. Okay. So here we go. We go back to the story. Verse 11. Saul sent some into David's house to watch it and kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, "If you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow, you'll be killed." So Michal let David down through a window. Now you got Saul's daughter helping him escape. So you can see Saul's got his son and his daughter on David's side. And he fled and escaped. Then Michal took a teraphim and laid it on the bed, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair on the head. When Saul sent the men to capture David, Michal said, "He's ill. Look at him. He hardly is moving. He's not even breathing." Then Saul sent the men back to see David and told them, bring him to me in his bed so that I may kill him myself. In other words, they came back, well, we can't kill David. He's not feeling well. So that don't even make sense. Bring him in his bed and I'll kill him. So they went in, they kicked the door in or whatever. I add that to the movie script. Verse 16, but when the men entered, there was the idol or the teraphim in the bed and the head was with some goat's hair. Saul said to Michal, why did you deceive me like this and send my enemy away so that he escaped? Why didn't you lie to me? Well, what's she going to do? Because I don't like you, Dad. I'm on David's side. No, she's. He said to me, let me get away. Why should I have to kill you too? He says, he was going to kill me if I didn't do this. Saul believes it. Okay. So David's escaped from that. We're assuming that's all taking place at Gibeah where Saul's at. He's going to go just, I mean, not far at all. I mean, you can see it. When you stand here, you can see these places here. Okay. And when you stand here, you can see these places too. So, I mean, they're all within, you know, a night's walk. When David had fled and made his escape, he went to Samuel at Ramah. And that's Samuel's hometown. That's where his mom, Hannah, lived, remember, when he was born. And told him all that Saul had done to him. He lays the story down to Saul. He says, Samuel, what do I do? You anointed me, and now all hell's broke loose in my life. I don't know where to go. Then he and Samuel went to Naoth and stayed there. Now, Naoth, again, that's another. Now, is Naoth another city somewhere? Maybe, but it appears as we read the story, he went to Ramah and met Samuel, and Samuel says, okay, why don't you come with me? We're going to go to the college. We're going to go to the dormitory. We're going to go to the apartment complex. I'll find a place for you to stay over there at Naoth at the camps where the prophets are at. So I think it's a place in Ramah where the prophets are. You don't have to accept that. I don't even accept it totally. It's like we're trying to explain what Naoth is. But he and Samuel went to Naoth and stayed there. Word came to Saul, here it is, David is in Naoth at Ramah. Okay, it kind of leads to that. So he sent men to capture him. But when they saw a group of prophets prophesying, you know, so they're in Ramah, moving into Naoth, and what do they see when they get to Naoth? They see the dormitories, they see the apartment complexes, or the word means, the noun means camps. Camps of what? Well, it looks like prophets. And they're all, this is interesting. This is really interesting right here, because you can follow this through the Bible, because it's going, this idea right here, of what we're mentioning here, is going to follow on up through the days of Elijah and Elisha, and they're training men to be prophets. And they're here, they're at Samuel's college, Samuel's seminary, being trained as prophets. I mean, I'm kind of tying the story together, but it appears that they're practicing prophecy. And you're going to see that with Elijah's men, Elisha's men. Remember when Elijah was taken up and Elisha went to all, he said goodbye to all the cities at Bethel and Jericho, and then he went across and all the young prophets were watching. And he says, don't, you know, they watch him go back. You know what I'm talking. I'll throw this in there. It appears that from Elijah and Elisha's school, Elisha trained a man, Jonah, was from that school of prophets, and it also fits. So Jonah comes out of that same school, potentially. It may have started right here in Naoth. But anyway, there's prophets. When they verse 20, so he sent men to capture him. But when they saw, interesting, they saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader. So David and Samuel has taken David down to Naoth, and that's where he's staying there, and he's leading some kind of class in prophesying, and they're practicing prophesying, whatever that looks like. The soldiers that Saul sends from Gibeah, they come up and they see, oh, they're having class right now. They're prophesying. And Samuel's leading them in the exercise, in the prophesying. Standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came upon Saul's men, and they also prophesied. Interesting. So now they bust in the classroom. Samuel's leading an exercise in prophesying, and all of a sudden they come in, boom, now they're prophesying. Saul was told about it, and he sent more men, and they prophesied too. So now the class is tripled in size. Saul sent men the third time, and they also prophesied. So the more they come in, it's kind of like the guards being sent by the Sanhedrin to arrest Jesus, and the guards come back. They go, well, did you bring him? They go, I've never heard a man talk like that. Did you hear what that man said? He knows what he's talking about. You guys ought to listen to him. They said, now the deceivers deceived you. You know, they send guards to arrest Jesus. The guards came back and says, we like him. We're going to start going to his class. And it's the same thing happens here. Saul three times sends men to arrest, to get David here at Naoth in Ramah. And now the class start off with, I don't know how many, so I say 20. Now you got 20 more guards, 20 more guards. Now you got an 80 people prophesying. Okay, so now this is the end right here, verse 22. Finally, he himself left for Ramah and went to the great cistern at Succoth, and he asked, where are Samuel and David? Over at Naoth at Ramah. They said, everybody's over there now. So Saul went to Naoth at Ramah. He goes to the apartment complex or the dormitory or the seminary. So Saul went to Naoth at Ramah, but the Spirit of God came upon him, and he walked along prophesying until he came to Naoth. As he's approaching, here comes the king with his, and he's not probably going by himself, he's got his entourage coming with him. And as he, by the time he gets to the college campus, he's also been overcome by the Spirit of God. He's prophesying. He stripped off his robes. That doesn't mean he stripped down naked. It means he takes off his identifying, the robes identified him as the king, and also prophesied in Samuel's presence. So he comes into the classroom, if you would, or however this is being played out. He comes in where Samuel's still leading the prophesying with his class and all the guards that have come to arrest David. David's there prophesying. And you got to understand, think about it. It's interesting because David is the great harpist who wrote many of the Psalms, and he would prophesy himself. So they're entering into this spiritual side. Remember when Elisha was down south with a couple of the kings, Jehoshaphat, and then the king from Israel, I forget his name, and they're going to battle against Edom and Moab and Ammon over here, and they said, tell us, what are we supposed to do? He says, here's what he says. Remember what Elisha says? He says, if it was just the king of Israel, I wouldn't even talk to you guys. I'd just let you perish out here. But because of you and you've got some kind of godliness, he says, I will help you. So bring me a harp. And they brought him a harp, and they began apparently playing music. And he began to prophesy, and he came up with the answer on how they're going to fight this battle. So it's kind of interesting that the music was that. You've got to assume there's probably some kind of music being done here. And David, there's music being played, the prophesying, whatever. So you've got all these people here. Saul comes stumbling into the presence of Samuel and all everyone prophesying, stripped off. All of his royal robes are stripped off. His entourage is probably like, here's the king. He's here to arrest David. He lay that way all that day and night. This is why the people say, is Saul also among the prophets? So in other words, where's Saul? Where's the king? He's down in the dormitory. He's down on the college campus. He's down with the prophets. He's laying on the floor in front of Samuel's conducting this prophesying seminar. The king is on his face in front of him, also prophesying. And let's just sing that one more time. And everybody's singing. And here's the king. It's like, no one's going to arrest David today because here's all the guards, here's the king, and the Spirit of God has got everybody under control. Just a very interesting situation there. Yeah, it's kind of a fun story. So now, this is why the people say, is Saul also among the prophets? Even the king is with the prophets. Okay, chapter 20. Then David fled from Naoth. So while Saul's on his face, all the guards are got there. I don't know if they've got their hands in the air, they're on their faces, whatever. They're all under the influence of the Spirit, prophesying, singing along. Then David fled from Naoth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, what have I done? What is my crime? Now, what have I wronged your father that he's trying to take my life? So he flees apparently back to Gibeah and he meets Jonathan here. Never, Jonathan replied, you are not going to die. No, he says, this can't be true. He says, because remember the covenant. I was there. I was the mediator. You guys shook hands. You came back in. You're playing the harp. He says, this is not true. He says, my dad wouldn't break his covenant. Never, Jonathan replied, you are not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything great or small without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so. Well, it's pretty obvious why he would hide it from you, Jonathan. But David took an oath and says, your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said to himself, Jonathan must not know this, or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there is only a step between me and death. And how close was that? Well, just a few minutes ago, I was standing, and Saul was laying here, and I was here. It's a breath away. I'm a breath away from being killed. Jonathan said to David, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it. So David says, look, tomorrow is the new moon festival. They would have, several feasts they'd get together. And I, the word I is emphatic, and I am supposed to a dine with the king. I'm supposed to dine with the king. I mean, he's just hunting me down. He tried to pin me to the wall. He came to my room to kill me. I wasn't there. He then brought my bed over to try to kill me. He then came to Ramah with three different sets of guards, finding himself trying to kill me. And now tomorrow, I'm supposed to dine with the king. What, am I going to just come in there and lay my head down on the table and cut it off? It's like, that's not going to happen. So, I mean, maybe you can, I'm adding some expression to it, but nonetheless it says, and I am supposed to dine with the king, and the word I is emphatic. But let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. So it'll be 2 days of feasting. He says, so 2 days, give me 2 days. I'll be hiding in the field. I will go out here and live in the wilderness. If your father misses me at them, tell him. David earnestly asked my permission to hurry to Bethlehem, his hometown. Now notice he's using a little bit of deception right here. And he's going to continue to use deception up in. I really wanted to get to chapter 21, and I'm not going to. He says, tell him I'm going down to Bethlehem for a family feast down there. I couldn't come to his new moon celebration here because I'm celebrating with my family in Bethlehem, which he's not. He's lying. If he says, very well, then your servant is safe. But if he loses his temper, you can be sure that he is determined to harm me. As for you, show kindness to your servant. Okay, you understand right there. He says, oh, okay, that's okay. I understand, David. But if it makes him really mad, you know something's on. So now in verse 8, two important words. As for you, show kindness. There's the covenant term. Show kindness to your servant. That's Hasid. Show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant. Two covenant terms right there. With you before the Lord. If I am guilty, then kill me yourself. And that's part of the covenant. If I am lying to you, if I've done something that your father is trying to kill me for just reasons, then it is in our covenant, it is in our seed, it's in our agreement that you should kill me because I'm lying to you. So he says, in our covenant, if I'm being deceitful, kill me now. And I mean, and it's legitimate. If I am guilty, then kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father? Never, Jonathan says. If I had the least inkling that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you? David asked, who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? Come, Jonathan says, let's go out into the field. So they get away from everyone. No one can hear the conversation. So they went out there together. Then Jonathan said to David, I'm going to have to wrap this up. We'll pick this up next time. Again, not next week or the following week. We're going to skip two Mondays. It will be whatever date that is. Basically, what happens here is, in case you say you're never going to come back, you can read it yourself. But they're talking here. He's going to hide in the field for 2 days. The first night at the feast, Jonathan's going to say David had to go to Bethlehem. Saul's going to say, oh, well, he must have been unclean or something, couldn't make it. The next night, he says, why is that son from Bethlehem, son of Jesse, not been here? He says, something's up. He says, and he tries to kill Jonathan, and Jonathan goes off and tells David, flee, you're right. And he shoots an arrow. You remember the whole arrow story? He shoots an arrow and hollers at his servant. Run for your life, basically. And David's going to run to guess where? He's looking for an answer. David is looking for an answer. You got to feel sorry for David. I mean, God just put him into this mix. He ran up to the prophet. Give me an answer. He ran back to Jonathan. Give me an answer. And now he's going to run where? He's going to run to the priest. He's going to run to the priest and say, I need some help. And he's going to lie to the priest, say, we're on a secret mission. I didn't bring any food. My men are hiding out there. And we were in such a hurry. We didn't bring any food and we didn't bring any weapons. Can you give me some food? And they say, well, we've got the consecrated bread that only the priest can eat. But here, you can have this. Jesus uses as an example of the Sabbath, that man is more important than the Sabbath. He uses that story. They give him the bread. And he said, what about a weapon? They go, well, we've got Goliath's sword here as a monument to God's greatness. You can have Goliath's sword. Oh, great. There's no sword like Goliath's sword, which is kind of a warning to David, meaning it's here as a monument to God's greatness because you killed him and you didn't even have a sword. Oh, great. Can I have that? It's like, why would you want Goliath? It's here testifying that God is greater than the sword. It's like, but yeah, if that's where you're at, David, here's the sword. Good luck. And so David takes Goliath's sword and he runs out and he realizes, oh my gosh, I'm in huge trouble. So he runs over. Guess where he goes? He can't get an answer from Samuel, can't figure out with Jonathan. The priest can't help him, so he flees. Guess where? He ends up going to Gath. He goes to the Philistines. And he walks into the Philistines, and you know the story, and he realizes, oh, man. And about that time, logic sets in, and he realizes, they're taking me in to see the king. And he realizes he's being escorted by the Philistine bodyguard, and all he's got is Goliath's sword. It's like, I'm getting set up to be killed. So he begins to fake insanity. He starts just, you know, he had spit running down his beard, that says, and just chopping, just hitting the posts and stuff in the palace, and comes in front of Achish the king. And they go, we captured David. He goes, he's a madman. Look at him. He's, you know, salivating and swinging and saying weird things, swinging at dragons and stuff. He goes, he's insane. Get him out of here. Don't kill him here. Because in the ancient world, the idea was if a man's having that kind of a fit, there's a demon possessing him. And if you kill him, the body's dead. What's the demon going to do? Go to the nearest body and take possession of him. So if you kill him, that demon comes into you. It's like, get him out of my palace. So David realizes, oh man, I'm in trouble. Only thing I can do is fake like I'm insane, and no one will kill me if I'm insane. Oh, I'm crazy. I'm fighting dragons. And they escort him out to the border of the country. And David goes, wow, what a trip. So he goes from boom, 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 from Gibeah to Ramah to Jonathan to Nob over to the Philistines. And then he comes back, and by that time, Saul is not up, not the priest there. Saul's come down and slaughters all the priests. And the priest's son ends up running over to David with the ephod and says, well, the priesthood's wiped out except for me. Here's the ephod. What's our next move? David goes, oh, man. I've made. And then that's what he realizes. He can't play on this chessboard, because by playing on this chessboard, he just wiped the priesthood out. By lying to the priest, they came to his side. How many other innocent people are going to die if David continues to play this? So now David runs and says goodbye to Jonathan. They end up, they both are crying. Or, you know, when he leaves Jonathan, I skip that part. They both start to cry. Or David, they both are crying, but David begins to cry because he realizes he's going to live now a life of a fugitive. I mean, 2 weeks ago, he's the national hero. Now, he's public enemy number one. The whole government now is against David. And there's all kinds of propaganda coming out how bad David is. And David's got nowhere to go except down to the hill country of Judea. We'll trace through that next time. That's a summary. I'm going to pray. Thank you for being here. Again, it's a great story as we watch David mature and grow and follow God. Father, do thank you again for the information we see here. We compare ourselves to David. We see the things that we've been challenged with and the growth that's required on our part, that we need to trust in you, that we need to continue to act wisely, but we cannot enter the game of manipulation and playing the same chess games and bringing innocent people into conflict. But Father, we ask that we might be like Jonathan, that we'd be people that would be men of God, people of God that follow you, be like Dave, that we're willing to grow and become the people you've called us to be. Again, we thank you for this information. I ask that you lead and guide us in Jesus' name. Amen. Hey, thank you for your time.